Welcome to Cover Conversations, a podcast created by the local Gov Health and Wellness team for both those who use our health insurance benefits and the employers who offer them. Each month, we'll have a conversation with relevant information related to the health insurance we provide. So sit back and enjoy this episode of Covered Conversations. On today's episode, we have Julie Sears. She is a clinical account consultant, a certified diabetes and education specialist, and at the root of it all, a registered nurse. She works for Blue Cross Blue Shield of Alabama, and she occasionally travels with us when throughout the state when we have our conferences. So we're so excited that you're here today, Julie. Thank you for coming.
Thank you for having me.
We also have Jessica O'Donnell. She is our Chief Benefits Officer for the Local Government Health Insurance Board, and myself, Michelle Walden, the Communications Director for the board. So we're excited today about this conversation, and we're going to talk all things type 2 diabetes, nutrition, all kinds of stuff. So thank you so much for coming.
Thanks.
So how long have you been with Blue Cross Blue Shield?
I have been with Blue Cross Blue Shield for 7 years.
Oh, wow. So what all do you – now, you have a lot. You have a lot of credentials to your name. What exactly do you do? What does all of that mean?
So for Blue Cross specifically, I have certain groups that I'm assigned to. So I have dedicated groups, and I follow those groups throughout the year. So any type of meeting they have, phone calls, I'm typically on those calls. I travel to those meetings. And essentially, my role as a clinical account consultant is to help kind of bridge the gap from a clinical standpoint and a financial standpoint. So I'm trying to link that information so groups understand a little bit more about maybe why they're spending money in a particular area from a cost standpoint, high cost claimants, frequent ER utilizers, medications. So there are a lot of different components to what I'm researching, data that I'm pulling and putting together, looking at trends. We do a lot for our individual groups because we want them to be aware of that clinical component and how it ties into the financial. So we are a little bit of a liaison. We are, I don't say a jack of all trades. So we do a lot of digging. We do a lot of research for our groups.
It does sound like you wear a lot of hats in this position. What brought you, with everything that you have, all your experience and expertise, what brought you to the area of like type 2 diabetes and becoming an expert there?
That specialty. So it's interesting. I've been a nurse for, gosh, I think 32 years now, which is crazy to think about. I've been a registered nurse for 32 years. And when I started initially, I actually started in labor and delivery. That was my love when I was in nursing school. So I started in that particular unit. I grew. I stayed there for about 8 years. Absolutely loved it. As I went back to school, I got another degree, and then I morphed into other places within the hospital, thinking of other degrees that I was then going to accomplish. But eventually what happened is I ended up getting married, I moved to another state, and with that, I had to find my place again, because clearly the hospital that I left, I was very very fond of. I love the people that I worked with. I had a great team. It's very hard to mimic that when you move, though. So I worked a couple of different places and really just tried to find my home. And within that, I ended up working at the university in Birmingham. I worked for Alabama and the University of Alabama in Birmingham. And I worked at the hospital for a little bit, and then I ended up moving over to the university side. And so within that, I started doing research. I stayed on the university side probably for about 15, 16 years. I did lung cancer research. It was super interesting, but that eventually morphed into me running a clinic for the university. And the clinic was basically a wellness facility, and we saw anybody that wanted to come in. It didn't matter what your income was. It did not matter what your status was. If you wanted to learn more about your health, then you came to this facility. So with that, I started seeing a lot of people that were pre-diabetic, diabetic, hypertensive. I did not know enough about some of what I was having to educate these people on. I was doing lab work. I was doing biometrics. But a big component of it was educating. And I knew a lot about most, but really the diabetes portion, I felt, because I'd been in OB for so long, I just lacked that component. And so I just set upon learning more about it. I just dug my heels in, started researching, kind of teaching myself, and then I found that I could go get this certification and become basically a diabetes specialist. I could get certified in that. And so I did, and I knew that if I did not do that, the people that were coming in to see me every day, I was basically, for a lot of them, I was their only resource. And if they didn't get it from me, they just weren't going to get it. So I learned as much as I could. I got certified, and then I felt better equipped to be able to educate them. When that facility closed down, I then had to look for another home, and that's how I ended up at Blue Cross Blue Shield. But I've been fortunate that because I have that skill set, they've allowed me to really utilize it in a lot of different ways and kind of get that from a knowledge standpoint. My trickle down is a lot greater now. It was wonderful being able to teach people individually. I love that. I think that's a very special thing to be able to do, but I have been able to use that skill broader within Blue Cross or the walls of Blue Cross Blue Shield. So I'm thankful for that.
That's incredible. That's incredible. So a big tie-in with type 2 diabetes has a lot to do with nutrition and food and things like that. And that's something I think that you're pretty well versed on. So, but I also think that there's a lot of confusion about what we should eat, what we shouldn't eat. And I believe Alabama is a leader of people who have type 2 diabetic diagnosis. I could be wrong about that, but I'm pretty sure that that's right. So are you able to better clarify kind of, and maybe what you talk to your patients, your former patients about, but are you able to better clarify the healthiest road to eating habits? Like, what should people be eating as far as, you know, whole foods versus processed foods, things of that nature?
So I think what people need to understand is that it really doesn't matter if you have prediabetes, you have diabetes, you don't have anything, which is what clearly is the preference. Regardless, we should all be eating the same way. It's not just, oh, you're pre-diabetic, you're a diabetic, you should be doing this. We should all be eating better. We should all be making healthier choices. So clearly, everything that you eat is going to affect your blood sugar. That there's no way around that. But the key is figuring out how to eat regular meals, how to eat the right amount, eat with good frequency. Those types of behaviors, learning how to do that is what helps people manage their blood sugar, whether they're pre-diabetic or diabetic or not, and clearly helps prevent, you know, complications down the road. When I talk to people about specifics regarding food intake, I want people to eat real food, or what I call whole food. So those types of foods would be very small amounts of sugar added, if no sugar added. That would be the preference. And so I try to steer people away from what I call processed foods. So the foods that we want people to eat ideally would be, I say, fresh. Now, frozen foods are not off the table. For some people, it's a better option. And clearly, it can be, from an expense standpoint, it can be a better thing to purchase. So I'm all about frozen. There are some things I prefer frozen. And I think people just have to make that decision. But fresh fruits, vegetables, beans, whole grains, lean proteins like chicken and fish, those are great places to start. I do want people to think about lowering their salt as well. So clearly, lowering sugar is important. Those types of foods that I just mentioned, they don't have a lot of sugar in them. Or even if it's a fruit and a vegetable, and it does, it's a naturally occurring sugar. That's what we want people to be taking in, because your body handles that better than all of the added sugar that people typically take in with a processed food. Other things that I want people to be mindful of are watching their, you know, amounts of saturated fat, the amount of red meat they eat, fried foods. Those are things that clearly can have an impact on cholesterol. And then at the end of the day, that's going to affect your vessels, your blood vessels, and then it can impact clearly your heart. So those are things that I definitely want people to keep in mind from a processed food standpoint, I think the easier way to understand that, and again, it's not that all of these are off the table, but when I think of processed foods, I think of things that are packaged, bagged, boxed. So you think of cereals, crackers, cookies, breads, pastries, chips. Those are things that are very processed. Even bread can be very processed, so you have to be careful with that. You want to, you know, make sure you're reading labels, look to see if it says enriched. Anything that says enriched probably means that certain things have been stripped out and then lots of things have been added in. So that's probably going to be a very processed item. But that's kind of the difference. When we talk about processed items, those are things that fall into that simple carb category, simple carbohydrates. We don't want people to eat a lot of simple carbohydrates. We want people to eat complex carbohydrates, because complex carbohydrates are items that are going to take longer for your body to process. So they don't affect your blood sugar as drastically as when people eat something that's processed. Processed items, they're very simple, and it's very simple for your body to break those down. Therefore, when that happens, your blood sugar typically spikes. What goes up must come down. Many times, your blood sugar is going to fall fairly quickly, and then people typically end up choosing another bad simple carb, another processed food, to get their blood sugar back up so they'll feel better, whether they really understand that's what's happening or not. And then people tend to get on a little bit of a hamster wheel with their blood sugar up and down and up and down. And that's what we want to avoid.
When you're eating those complex carbs, you say it takes longer for your body to break down. So, and forgive my ignorance, does that mean that your body will typically stay fuller longer, so you may not eat as much?
Correct.
Okay.
Yes, because if you're eating things that are nutrient dense, they have more fiber, they have more water content, those are things that are going to affect your hunger levels, and you will feel fuller longer. So there are a lot of good reasons to eat the foods that I mentioned.
That's awesome. Thank you so much for clarifying that.
Imagine a future free from type 2 diabetes and excess weight, with the energy and confidence to do the things you love with the ones you love the most. With Virta, this can be your story. With Virta's one-on-one care team support, interactive app, and supportive member community, you too can lose weight, reduce medications, and save money so you can get back to what you love. Learn more about our benefits on our website, lghip.org, to find out how you can take your life back with Virta.
I may have a sugar problem. I love to eat sugary things. I think that I might have an addiction to cookies and cakes and all the things. It's bad. But I find that when I eat just one cookie, I'll say, oh, I'll just have just one cookie. I can't eat just one. I have to eat a lot. I eat way more than I should, and then I regret lots of things afterward. Why is that? Why do you know the science behind that, of why I can't just eat just one? Like, my body just wants more and more?
Part of that would probably – I would say it's probably twofold. Part of it comes down to, what else have you done during the day? When you're reaching for that cookie or your brownie, historically, what has already happened during the day as far as what you've eaten? Are you starving when you pick up that cookie or that brownie or that treat? Have you been eating other things in the day that are higher in protein? What does the rest of your day look like? I think that's going to be part of why you may be eating more than what you would like, because maybe your blood sugar's low and maybe one's not quite enough because your body's telling you get your blood sugar up, and therefore you reach for a second, you reach for a third. Part of that has to do with what I call kind of the reward center of your brain. So when you reward yourself and your brain releases dopamine, which is basically that, ah, this feels so good, thank you so much for eating that brownie or that cookie, then many times, of course, we're going to want to reach for another one because your reward center is activated. So there is some science behind it, but I think you also have to look at, what did the rest of your day look like before you reach for that cookie. I'm all about moderation. Food brings a lot of joy to a lot of people. We celebrate with food. So I'm not a fan of wiping out complete categories of food. I think people still need to be able to enjoy food. But again, you have to be able to regulate that, and you have to be smart about it, and you have to choose when you have those treats. Everything you eat cannot be a treat. It just can't. We need to eat for survival. We need to eat for energy. And unfortunately, most people are overly focused. They focus too much on what am I eating next. We've got to try to figure out how to step away from that.
Do you ever have any recommendations as far as like, because people may not be fully aware of what they're eating through the day, or they may just be mindlessly eating of, do you ever recommend kind of food journaling or tracking your food? I know there are apps and stuff available for that. Is that something that you recommend?
I'm a big fan of that. When I worked at UAB, when I ran that or helped run that clinic, the clinical portion of it, I did 24-hour recalls on people all the time, because it's amazing how people in their minds are like, I'm doing everything right. I'm doing it right. I'm eating good. I'm doing all these wonderful things. What's the problem? Why don't I feel better? Why am I not losing weight? But then when you sit down and you actually do the 24-hour recall, things come to light a little bit better, and they're like, oh, I kind of forgot about that, or I forgot I ate that slice of cake, or I had those, you know, two Cokes, or all of a sudden when somebody else is asking for it, it looks a little different on paper. So I am, because people, they just, it's harder to keep up with if you're not putting it down. So I'm a huge fan of using an app. If you think that will help you reach a goal, by all means do that. Journal. I think you could probably buy literally like habit journals. There are so many things that are offered now. Write down what you're doing. Get a sticky note. I don't really care how you do it. Just write it down, because if you don't write it down, you'll forget. And you're probably going to, you're just not going to be quite as honest with yourself as you need to. So I think people need to see it on paper, see it on an app, and I think it will help you move toward a goal easier if you have it in front of you.
Yep, yep. I agree with that. I started doing that myself as far as what I eat. I also, I had a wellness screening a year ago, and my cholesterol was higher. So Jessica told me to, you know, less intake of sat fats and things like that. And so I didn't realize really what I was eating. So I started tracking more, and it was amazing, because I thought, oh, well, this says it's healthy on the outside, but really it wasn't. So I think tracking is, and it really doesn't take much time. Of course, everybody has to do what's best for them and their lifestyle. But it just makes me a lot more accountable. But you're right, I lie to myself all the time. So especially about what I'm eating.
And I'm glad you mentioned the Coke, Julie, because a lot of people, we focus on what we eat, but we drink a lot of calories too. And a lot of things that we drink have those refined sugars in them. So I'm glad you mentioned that. So it's also important to think about what you drink and to journal those as well.
Yes, definitely. And I think part of the problem is a lot of people, they're not, from a food standpoint and even from a drink standpoint, I call those good liquid calories that people, they don't think about. People don't understand food. They're not educated enough about it. And I think because of that, people are clearly, I mean, we have to make choices every day. We're going to make, you know, good choices or bad choices, and it's up to us to do that. But I think educating people about food is a key component, clearly, for people to make better decisions, because I think a lot of people, they don't understand why something is good versus bad. And that's why a lot of bad choices are made, because they just don't understand food. From a liquid standpoint, yes, people, I think, in their minds think I'm going to drink this large, you know, coffee or one of these frou-frou drinks from a cafe. They're going to go get, you know, a 20-ounce soft drink. You know, we do use the term Coke all the time, but just a soft drink, period. A 20-ounce soft drink has 17 teaspoons of sugar in it.
Oh my gosh.
If you looked at that, if you literally dipped out 17 teaspoons of sugar and you looked at that, you might actually think twice about putting that in your system. It's way over the allotted amount for what a man or a woman should be having during the day from a sugar standpoint. I think a man is like 9 teaspoons. Maybe a female's intake is 7. 17 teaspoons just in a soft drink. So people, I think, in their minds, they think I'm going to drink this drink and it's just going to go through me and I'm going to get rid of it. They're not thinking about the calories that are attached, but your body has to process that just like it would a food item. So that's one of the first things when I did recalls with people when I worked in the clinic. That was one of the first things we had to pinpoint. We've got to figure out how to get this liquid, all these liquid calories that you're consuming, whether it's soft drinks, those frou-frou kind of coffee drinks,
sweet tea, sweet tea in the South,
sports drinks. There are juices. Oh my, I had a lot of people that drank a lot of orange juice, a lot of pineapple juice. I like pineapple, but I don't really want to drink pineapple juice all the time. But those types of things are super concentrated and they are clearly going to affect your blood sugar. So that was one of the first things I had to pinpoint when I did those 24-hour recalls. Okay, we've got to get this down, because even just limiting that, and I'm not saying go cold turkey. Now, some people can go cold turkey, and if they can do that, then great. But other people, because they were drinking maybe 6 soft drinks a day, whether it be 6 cans or 6 20-ounce, I had people that were drinking 1 and 2 liters of Mountain Dew a day. Yeah, I don't even know. It was crazy. It's crazy to think about what people put in their bodies. But again, until you put it on paper, you can't really be honest with yourself about what you're doing. So that was one of the categories that I really had to get people to pull back on. And that's typically what we did first, even over food, because it was a little bit easier. Hey, let's bring that soda habit you have down a little bit. And as we bring the soda habit down, we're going to increase the water. If you can do it cold turkey, great. But it's really better to kind of, you know, taper it down, and then elevate the water intake.
We talk about a lot of the sugar and all the things, especially those additives that are in the processed foods. But going into more of your research with type 2 diabetes, can you kind of explain exactly what type 2 diabetes is?
Well, diabetes, from a clinical standpoint, is a disease of the metabolism. And I think that's how I would explain it clinically. In layman's terms, it's high blood sugar. So I think for someone that knows someone that's a diabetic, or they just think of the term diabetes, probably the immediate response in someone's mind is, oh, somebody has high blood sugar. So that technically that is not wrong. So there are different levels of blood sugar that we can check. So we do kind of categorize different levels when it comes to diabetes. But I would say, in order to understand that better, it's best to understand what normal metabolism is. So normal metabolism, what should happen in someone's body that's not having any issues with blood sugar, the simple version is we eat and then or drink. And so technically we are taking that in because our body needs fuel or energy. Most times, clearly, hopefully, we're hungry. Now, that's part of the issue, is a lot of times people are mindlessly eating, which again is one of those behavior modifications that have to be dealt with over time. But when we eat or drink and we take that fuel or that energy in, that is absorbed by our body. And when that happens, our blood sugar naturally rises. When your blood sugar rises, your pancreas, which is a vital organ that's kind of tucked behind your liver, it has all these beta cells on it. And your beta cells are what make your insulin. So your beta cells your pancreas will excrete insulin. Insulin is again, vital component to your body running optimally. So it is basically what I would call, it's essential to growth and survival. You have to have it. It has a lot of important functions within the body. One of those functions is to get your blood sugar back down to a normal kind of resting, I'll say a resting rate, but a resting level. So in order to do that, basically what insulin tells your body to do is, hey, I know you've got some stored fat over here. I want you to hold on to that. You may need it for a rainy day. We may need some energy one day that you know, if we don't have anything coming in. Don't use that fat storage. We need to use everything that's circulating in the bloodstream. This person just took something in, you know, they ate, they drank. Now we have this fuel, we need to use it, but we want to disperse it to, say, you know, a little bit of it to maybe the muscle. We need to send some of this energy to the liver, but we need to get these levels that are in our bloodstream back down to normal. We don't want to use this fat. So that's basically what insulin is doing. So again, super vital to how our bodies function. So I typically use the analogy when I would have patients come in to see me in the clinic, because they always understood this. I know everybody has probably played the game Pac-Man. They know what that game is. They've heard of it. They kind of get the gist on how that works. So essentially, you have Pac-Man. The whole point of Pac-Man on the screen is to go around and eat as many of those little dots as possible. So Pac-Man's mouth is opening and closing very quickly. So I would tell the patients that would come in, imagine that my fist is Pac-Man, okay? So Pac-Man, when you look at my fist clenched, clearly Pac-Man's mouth is not open. So in order to get Pac-Man's mouth open, insulin is the key to opening Pac-Man. Pac-Man is a cell. Pac-Man is a cell within my body that needs that energy, that fuel, that sugar that's floating around in the bloodstream. If Pac-Man does not open its mouth, then all of this sugar is just kind of dinging around the cell. It can't get in there, and our body needs that fuel. So in order for Pac-Man to open, again, insulin is the key. It unlocks that cell, and so then that cell can uptake that energy. And that's how we bring those blood sugars down. When insulin cannot open that Pac-Man, you end up with a lot of sugar floating around. You end up with a lot of insulin floating around, and then a person's blood sugar levels will start to get abnormal. They'll get in an abnormal range.
It's a great analogy. It's a great visual.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm just learning so much. Like, this is incredible. We offer a type 2 diabetic program, but I really haven't educated myself enough on what everything means and what even how our bodies function. I should probably know more about this. So with all of that information, with how the cell is and how the insulin has to get into it, so that way the Pac-Man will eat it all and disperse the energy.
Well, Pac-Man, I say uptake. It has to move around and uptake energy. Or consume that energy.
Yeah, yeah. Okay. With that, and everybody's body is different, but are some people just more predisposed or genetically predisposed to getting that diagnosis?
I would say that there are genetic components to a lot of different disease processes that we inform, whether it's me being at Blue Cross informing groups about, or in the past when I would just inform individual people. So there are a lot of genetic components, but I think a lot of people tend to get stuck on the fact that mom or dad had diabetes, Aunt Betty or Aunt Jane or Uncle Bob, they had diabetes. So it's probably just going to happen. I just need to go ahead and accept the fact that I'm going to be a diabetic. And that is not the case. Now, can some people have more of a genetic component than others? Sure, that's always possible. But, and I know you've heard this before, but I tell people your DNA is not your destiny. I know people have heard that many times, but your DNA is not your destiny. Just because you have a genetic component, typically what has to happen is we have to do something to exacerbate that genetic component. So, and a lot of it comes through from a social standpoint. There are a lot of components that get rolled into how we exacerbate that genetic component. So what we do, you know, on a daily basis, again, are we going to have good habits? Or are we going to have bad habits? Those short-term decisions that we make affect us long-term. So our long-term health is very determined by the little choices that we're making every day. So that's why we have to opt to try to make more good decisions when it comes to food and activity over the bad. So, yes, a genetic component can be there, but at the end of the day, a lot of what we do exacerbates that. So when people are not active, when they are overweight or obese or they smoke, we know that those are major contributing factors to people becoming diabetic. But part of what they contribute to is kind of that ramp up to someone becoming a diabetic. So when someone has that risk factor, they are going to be more at risk of getting or becoming insulin resistant. And then insulin resistance then trickles into prediabetes, and then prediabetes then trickles into diabetes. So I can explain a little bit more about that process if you'd like me to. For me, it's really kind of a warning stage. It's your body's way of saying, hey, we have a problem here. You need to do something about it now, because that's a time frame when you actually can do something about it. It's not when somebody becomes diabetic. They can't learn to manage blood sugar, eat better, be more active, but you don't want to wait. You don't want to be straddling the fence and then one day you fell off the fence and now you're on the side that's diabetic. You want to do something about it before you get to that, because then from a complication standpoint, from a risk standpoint, you're just setting yourself up for more complications down the road. So you want to hopefully not even get in any of those categories. You want to stay in that normal metabolism category. But if you don't, your best opportunity to do something about it is when you're in that insulin resistance phase or the pre-diabetic phase.
So really a lot of it has to do with, I mean, we're kind of the product of our own environments too. And
correct.
Breaking that cycle. And while there may not be healthy habits that started in childhood and just, you know, followed us through adulthood, but making some small, subtle changes could impact us tremendously as far as, you know, kind of breaking that cycle, in essence.
Correct.
So that's
because
amazing.
You have to look at what, when people go, oh, well, so-and-so family member has it, I might as well just be accepting. I know, but what kind of life are they living? Are they inactive? Are they overweight? Are they making poor decisions with their food? Are they smoking? Are they drinking? All of those things are compounding issues when it comes to someone becoming a diabetic. So you have to, instead of just taking it and saying it's just a done deal, look at what those people did throughout their lifetime, because diabetes doesn't happen overnight. This is a process that takes years to develop. So you're not just going to be normal one day and then all of a sudden you wake up the next day and you're not. If someone's metabolism is not working correctly, if they're not in that what I call normal zone, you know, that precursor of being insulin resistant, what happens is, you know, technically you should eat, your sugar goes up, your pancreas reacts, your blood sugar comes back down. But for somebody who is, maybe they're just consuming way too much day in and day out, they're just taking way more fuel in than they need over and over and over, over months, possibly years. Well, clearly, when you can't use all of that fuel, your body has to do something with it. So when you overconsume because of the way insulin works in the body, it says store it, store it, store it. So you've got to store all of that excess somewhere and it becomes fat. We now know through years of research, whereas before we thought fat was just a dormant storage. It's just storage. It's not doing anything. But now we know that's actually not the case. Fat is metabolically active. It secretes hormones. It affects all of your vital organs in an adverse way. So it is actually doing something, and we don't want people to have all that excess fat on them. Over time, when somebody consumes and consumes and consumes, and they have all that extra energy that's being stored as fat, basically what the pancreas does is initially it will put out more insulin, more insulin. I've got to work harder. I've got to work harder. I've got to try to get these blood sugars down. Well, it may actually be able to accomplish that for a while, but at a certain point, your insulin, your pancreas says, wow, I'm tired. I just can't keep doing this. They keep pushing me to the limit and pushing me to the limit. I'm just not going to work as effectively. And then sooner or later, you're just not going to put out enough. And again, another analogy that I like to use there is an air conditioner. Your pancreas is like an air conditioner. If you go into a room every day and it is, say, 85, 90 degrees, whatever the temperature is, and you go, wow, it's hot in here. I've got to cool this room off and I want to do it quick. And you pull the thermostat down to, say, 60. If you do that over and over and over, day after day after day, week after week after week, and you make the air conditioner work as hard as it can, harder than it should be having to work, eventually the air conditioner is not going to be very effective, right? Mm-hmm. It's going to freeze up. It's going to run out of Freon. That's basically what happens to your pancreas. It just can only work so hard for so long, and then it says, I'm done. Once that occurs, then the person typically will, you know, their blood sugars will just become abnormal. So once that insulin resistance phase occurs, then a person's blood sugar does start to rise. And at that point, the person would be declared pre-diabetic. So the pre-diabetes stage is higher blood sugars. They're not as high as what we would deem somebody that's diabetic. Again, I talked about we kind of have criteria. We have different levels that we say somebody is pre-diabetic versus diabetic. But that's kind of the process that someone would move through, that insulin resistance, they're pre-diabetic. And then if they still continue to not manage their blood sugar or, you know, modify their behaviors, then those blood sugars are going to continue to rise and rise, and then eventually the person would become diabetic. So that's basically the process. But again, when somebody is in those warning stages before they become a diabetic, that's the best time to do something about it. But the only way they're going to know to do something about it is if they're being tested. So if people don't have a PCP, if they don't have a doctor that they're seeing every year, if they're not getting wellness screenings through their employers, there are lots of different ways that people can get screened during the year. Even if they're getting a wellness screening, everyone needs a physician. Everyone should have an established physician that they see during the year. But people need to know their numbers. Again, it's about being educated. You've got to know your numbers. You need to know either what your blood sugar is or your A1C. Your A1C tells you basically a three-month kind of a percentage of what your blood sugars have been doing over a three-month period of time. So you have to know your numbers, because if you don't, and you have to know your risk factors. People need to know, guess what? Being overweight, being obese, smoking, not getting any physical activity, those are all contributing factors to someone becoming insulin resistant, pre-diabetic, and then diabetic. So education, education, education.
Yeah, I'm glad you mentioned the wellness screening. It's a great opportunity for the employees and the members to take advantage of those wellness screenings, to talk to those health coaches, to understand your numbers. So I'm glad that you brought that up, because that's a perfect opportunity to know what your numbers are, to know what your risk factors are.
Have you heard about our newest benefit, Hinge Health, to help reduce joint and muscle pain? Hinge Health provides members with personalized, expert-developed exercise therapy plans for lasting pain relief. So whether it's a new injury or ongoing aches, Hinge Health is for anyone living with joint or muscle pain. Hinge Health is available to eligible employees at no additional cost. And the care team includes a physical therapist and qualified health coach. You can always connect with them via text, email, phone call, or video chat to ask questions, set goals, and so much more. Visit hinge.health/LGHIP-enroll to learn more and apply today.
So what happens, though, if somebody has type 2 diabetes and they let it go untreated? What are some of the things that could happen to them?
There are a lot of different complications that can occur for someone that has diabetes. So a lot of times people, you know, they're not monitoring themselves. They're not taking their medications. They're not doing whatever their care plan is that their physician has given them. I think a lot of people, again, from an education standpoint, they don't know you don't know what you don't know. They don't know that having diabetes puts you at a greater risk for certain complications. I think they understand that it probably might be a little risky business and something might happen down the road, but I don't think people have clear-cut information sometimes on what their risk is. Or I think a lot of people just think, that won't happen to me. That's not going to happen to me. I'll worry about it later. I'll deal with it later. But there are a lot of serious health problems that can come with someone being diabetic. And I think kind of an easy trickle down, it's a bad trickle down, but one of the things that we talk to with the groups when we go out, or when I go out as a CAC, a clinical account consultant, is that trickle down of when somebody's overweight, and then someone being overweight, then they become, you know, pre-diabetic, and then all of a sudden their blood pressure starts getting a little abnormal, and now they have hypertension, and now they have diabetes, or maybe they become diabetic and then they become hypertensive. And then from there, their kidneys aren't functioning as well, and now they end up with CKD, which is chronic kidney disease, and then they could end up on dialysis, they could end up with an amputation. You know, diabetes is a disease of, I'll say, the vessels. It's a disease of the metabolism, but the outcome of it is a macrovascular and a microvascular disease. So it doesn't discriminate. It affects little tiny vessels and it affects big vessels. So a lot of the complications, or the major complications that can occur from somebody being diabetic, they could end up having a stroke. They could have heart disease. They could have neuropathy, which is numbness or tingling in their hands or their feet. Again, amputation because it affects, you know, vision. They could have vision loss or even blindness. And again, they could have kidney failure. There are a lot. The trickle down of not controlling your blood sugar early on, there are a lot of bad things that can happen down the road. And it's just, again, it's kind of a compounding issue, because when your blood sugar is high all the time, when those levels are high, and it damages blood vessels that supply nerves or nutrients to other places in your body, when that damage is done and nutrients can't get where it needs to go, whether it's a, you know, little tiny vessels, big vessels, vital organs, then you're going to have damage basically throughout the body.
Man, so I just had no idea of all of this. You know, it's incredible how it impacts somebody so fully. Well, we do have a program for type 2 diabetes. Jessica, do you want to talk about that?
Yeah, we offer a program for type 2 diabetic spouses and subscribers. We offer Virta. Virta has been a fantastic program, and it's a great option for these members. They get health coaching that's personalized and customized to them. They get nutritional education, diet plans. We also provide them with all the testing supplies that they need, along with some Bluetooth scales that go to a personalized app that their health coach sees. And so it really makes the members accountable, and those health coaches follow up and provide all the education that they need. And again, this is a free program for our eligible subscribers and spouses.
And we're really seeing, and Julie, you're familiar with Virta. We're really seeing a lot of our members who are taking advantage of this program and how it's being so positively impactful on their lives, and getting off their medications and reversing their type 2 diabetic diagnosis, and just really just overall just changing, I keep saying trajectory, but changing the trajectory of their life. Do you have any comments or anything about Virta?
Yes, I'll say your group in particular has had great success on Virta. It is an awesome program. And again, you know, it's offered for type 2 diabetics, and it is one of the leading treatments to help reverse type 2 diabetes. That is kind of their tagline, is to reverse it. And really, at the end of the day, what they are trying to do is teach people how to make those behavior modifications. And so there is a huge coaching element to that. It works with that nutritional, you know, therapy and a kind of advanced telehealth, and it's kind of merged together. And having that repetitive coaching and having access to those coaches over and over is what helps members continue to make those healthy choices or form those healthy habits. And that in the long run is what helps them, you know, lose weight, because typically most people with diabetes, they do need to lose weight, but it helps them maintain their blood sugars better. They become more active. They learn how to eat better. So I think it's a wonderful program, and I hope that more of your members will, you know, reach out and learn more about that program and see if they're eligible.
Awesome. Do you have any other comments or anything about the subject? You're kind of our subject matter expert.
So let's talk about real quick how important water is to your overall health. So we talked a little bit earlier about being mindful of liquid calories, because people do tend to drink a lot of sweet tea, sports drinks, juices, flavored coffees, whatever it is that they prefer. People just drink too much of that, and they're not really aware of how those types of liquid calories affect them internally. So again, we talked about reducing those and trying to increase water intake. I think what people don't understand, number one, they don't understand how little water they're drinking. I hear people all the time. I would have people come into my clinic. How much water do you drink? Oh, I drink plenty of water. I get enough. Oh, really? Well, let's talk about that. Let's talk about how much water you actually drink. And then lo and behold, wow, you took in 16 ounces. That's not enough. Oh, you drank 24 ounces. That's not enough. So again, it's that education component, just like how people view food. I'm pretty sure I know I'm eating healthy. I'm eating these things. Yes, but those things aren't healthy. The same thing holds true with drinks and with not getting enough water. People think they're getting enough and they aren't. Water has a lot of health benefits that people don't think about. So it's calorie free. It aids in your metabolism. It's good for your joints. Your joints need to be flush with water and cushy, so your mobility's better, so you feel better. It transports nutrients. It flushes out sugar. It does so many vital things in the body, and people just don't think about that. And therefore, it's really not important, I guess, how much they get during the day. I tell people, especially if they don't have any fluid restrictions, I want people to try to drink half of their weight in water. So an example for that would be a 140-pound person would drink 70 ounces of water. That would be good for someone who weighs 140. That's half. Now, technically, we could all drink way more than that, most likely. Again, if you don't have any fluid restrictions given to you by a physician, a lot of times those would be, you know, maybe heart patients. But water, water, water. There's so much good to that. What people don't understand as well is that the more water you drink, and now I don't want people to drink water all day and they don't eat good either. You have to have both components together. But water, just like eating the correct food during the day, more nutrient-dense food, water will keep you fuller during the day. And then, of course, that will help you reduce your calorie intake. And again, for most of these people, they need to be reducing their calorie intake, because we want to get rid of that excess storage that they have, i.e. the fat. Thirst and hunger mimic each other. So a lot of times when people are constantly eating, it's because they're actually thirsty. So that's why if people increase their water intake during the day, most likely their food consumption will go down, because again, thirst and hunger mimic each other. So again, water, water, water. It's key for people who are diabetic. When I would have people come into the clinic and I would do their blood sugar, their A1C, if their numbers were high, I would tell them, go drink a bottle of water, go walk for 30 minutes. So those are two things, because when you're drinking water, it will help flush, keeps your kidneys hydrated, but it will help flush that excess sugar out. And then activity, of course, helps your body utilize that excess sugar that's floating around, because when you're using your body and you're being physically active, your muscles need it. You know, you're going to be uptaking or consuming, as Jessica said earlier, your body's going to use that excess sugar that's floating around. So another key component for all of us to do, not just diabetics, but anyone that's diabetic, pre-diabetic, or in that normal metabolism category, get that water in, watch those sugary drinks, eat good food, but activity is a key component as well. So for someone who is a diabetic, I want them to be doing some type of activity at least every other day. I don't really want them to go more than 2 days without activity, because again, activity is what helps your body use some of that excess fuel that's just floating around. So it doesn't have to be crazy movement, but when you exercise helps the body regulate insulin production. It helps the body become more sensitive to the insulin, so it's going to be more likely to use the insulin. So, and when that happens, it's going to have a better, or it's going to be easier for your body to manage and get those levels back down to what would be more of a normal level. So again, with even activity, great things about it. It helps sleep, can reduce stress and anxiety. Again, it can help from a weight standpoint, because most people that are diabetic, they typically are carrying a little more weight. It helps reduce blood pressure. It can help with cholesterol. So there's a lot of different benefits to getting activity. The main thing I want people to concentrate on is getting a certain amount of cardio during the week. We generally say about 150 minutes of cardio. You know, break it up, 20-minute, 30-minute, you know, little amounts of time. And then also try to get a little bit of resistance training, because if you take someone who's walking and you compare them to someone who is walking and doing, say, even just 2 days of resistance training during the week, or strength training, whatever you want to call it, weights, bands, you can use your body as resistance. But if you're doing those types of activity with the walking compared to someone who's only walking, the person that's doing the walking and the resistance training, at the end of the day, that's going to be a better combination, because they will use more of that circulating sugar. Because when you use your muscles, then you kind of stay in this afterburn mode, whereas somebody who's walking is not going to have that afterburn. You really don't burn a lot of calories when you walk. Now, I'm not telling people to go run or anything like that, but that's why the resistance training component is so important, because it allows your body to burn more calories, stay in a little bit of an afterburn mode, and then if you wait a day or two and then you resistance train again, then you just kind of hype your body back up into that phase again. And so that's super important. Those people tend to end up reducing their weight easier and quicker because they end up burning fat. So again, doing some type of cardio, brisk walking, and the resistance training, that's a great combination. And I want people to try to focus on that during the week, along with getting their water. Try to get as good rest as you can. Sleep is a vital component. And again, making those healthy food choices.
I've also found that when moving your body, just a little bit of movement helps with that afternoon crash. So that afternoon being tired and just getting up and walking for 15 minutes, whatever the case is, I have found that gives me more energy. It takes energy to make energy. So if I move my body on a daily basis in some kind of capacity, whether it's walking or with strength training, I find that I have more energy throughout the day. So,
yeah, it may take a little bit to get motivated to do it, but just like eating too many brownies or too many cookies, the reward, the feel good of that movement, and how you end up feeling after the fact, you're going to want to go back and get more and more and more. So definitely, you know, if you're sitting during the day a lot, maybe you're, you know, home-based, or even if you're in an office, if you're sitting, you know, set some reminders on your phone. Try to get up, walk down the hallway, go outside, walk around the building a couple of laps. I think once people get into that mindset and they understand how much better they feel when they do those things, clearly it's a lot easier to keep doing them. And I think too, you know, even with the food, when people start eating better and they start making better food decisions, and then they realize, wow, I really do actually, I feel so much better when I eat that versus maybe when I had the hamburger and fries. Hamburger and fries, I'm not saying don't eat it, but that's got to be something that's done
in moderation.
Yes, you have to be mindful of those types of things, because it's not good nutrition and it's way too much fuel, because, you know, we only need, depending on what we're doing during the day, everybody's a little different, but everybody's fuel needs or their energy needs are different, and everybody's energy expenditure is different. So again, it's just learning and being educated on a lot of different components, but it can be done. It can be done.
Thank you, Julie.
I think, you know, one of the things kind of in closing, what I want people to remember is when they are making changes, when they are trying to form good habits, to make small steps. Many people can do a lot of different goals, you know, in one at once. But most people need to make small changes. They need to make small goals for themselves. And I think that's important, because if you try to do too much at once, it can be overwhelming. And then if it's overwhelming, chances are you're not going to stick to it. So I think a good example of that would be, oh, I've got to eat better. I'm going to go to the grocery store and I'm basically going to buy one of everything in the produce section. Don't do that. Don't do that, because you're probably going to end up wasting a lot of money when you get home. And then you're like, oh my gosh, what do I do with all this stuff? Now I've got to find recipes. I've got to eat all this. How do I do this? It's overwhelming. And then most people end up not sticking to the plan, and they end up having a lot of food that ends up going bad, probably.
Or it's overwhelming.
It is overwhelming. So make small changes. I tell people to eat out of a box, and I don't mean out of an actual box, but limit, simplify what it is you're doing. Pick a few healthy things that you might want for breakfast. Let's stick to that for a little bit. Pick a few healthy things you might want to do for lunch. Great. Do the same for dinner. Pick a few snacks that you think you might would want to eat during the day. And I call that eating out of a box. Just narrow it down. You can broaden your horizons later. Make it easy on yourself and simplify it, because, you know, I do, for a diabetic especially, I do want them to get up in the morning, eat within about an hour, and then try to eat frequently during the day. I know there are all these fads and trends and quick fixes, but for a diabetic, they really need to get up in the morning and eat, get control of what they're doing. So I want them to get up and eat fairly promptly, and that way, if they eat something good, it's easier to stay in control during the day. If you wait too long, you don't eat something good, chances are you're probably going to crash and burn. You're going to overconsume at the end of the day. But if you mess up, if you overindulge, if you make a bad choice, don't give up. You know, you have to stay the course. We all slip. We all have a bad day. We all maybe don't make a goal that day. Oh, I said I was going to walk X amount of days this week. I didn't do it. Well, if I don't do it, I can't just throw in the towel and say, I'm done. I'm not going to try anymore. You have to get back on that path and just try to make a better choice the next time with, you know, what you're eating, what you're drinking, and your activity. So, you know, don't beat yourself up too bad. Just stay the course.
And keep in mind that baby steps are still steps forward.
Correct.
And time is going to pass anyway.
Right.
So you might as well try to make those little steps, and those little steps are eventually going to turn into a pretty good long-term path.
Right.
So, Julie, this has been wonderful. And Jessica, thank you so much for joining today. Thank you so much for coming and talking to us a lot about this subject, Julie. We really appreciate it.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.